The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Here we are, pre-equinox, woofy time. And so we know, you know, we are really increasingly dedicated to those who are escapade artists. I remember that trickster really is older than humans. Let's think of it as bodhisattva coyote that with a hurl of lightning sets the whole shebang going. And then this sizzle moves through history and all organisms every now and then being inquisitioned and imprisoned, but learning craftily how to escape, you know, and it's in each one of us too, awaiting this time. So there's a beautiful sky earth story. I'll be giving equinox event with Amakayla Gaston in a rare historic reunion in Washington, D.C. Sunday night. You can find out about that at coyotenetworknews.com. And then we're opening up our Trickster Training Council Monday night by phone or web to everybody again. Trickstertraining.com will get you there. So more than perfectly, we welcome back, I think it was 7 years ago, author Tony Vigoretto with his latest novel, Love and Other Pranks, that Tom Robbins says maybe the single wildest novel I've ever read, which is pretty great because it's kin to Tom Robbins, but completely teased into immediate pertinence for us. And his website is tonyvigoretto.com. So welcome, Tony.
Oh, thanks very much.
Yeah, so as I said to you just briefly backstage, I go, ooh, I do love this because I've often yearned for anything sacred or holy or pretentious to have a South Park episode done about it, just to keep it honest. And this is better. This is better because it's satire with heart. But maybe we begin with the holy company of beautiful people, which is a wonderful theme in your novel.
Sure. In the modern day side of the story, the primary antagonist is the holy company of beautiful people, which is a sort of a latter day New Age cult, but only in the worst sense of the word. So that was actually inspired by. When I lived in Austin, Texas, I happened to befriend a half a dozen former members of a cult that had recently imploded there in Austin. And so listening to their stories, I'm also a social psychologist, I was just sort of inspired to learn more about cults in general and, you know, worked out how they were, you know, so successful at manipulating, you know, otherwise intelligent people. So, yeah, that was the genesis of that. I was, you know, obviously I took it, you know, in many, many more directions than the original cult that inspired it. But it is worth noting that the original cult that inspired this book, they just finished a documentary about it, which premiered at Sundance last year, and it's called Holy Hell. I highly recommend checking it out.
Excellent. No, that's great. And we should, again, weave context for our listeners for this book that I highly recommend because, again, it's satire brought into complete pertinence with really, you know, our team and how we get conned and how we get liberated. I love that, you know, Ivan, the weaving of the context is you do very skillfully go back and forth modern time to where are the pirates or where is that 18th century?
Yeah, 18th century Caribbean, golden age of piracy, essentially.
Right. So again, you know, many authors have attempted this wonderful conceit of, you know, the French lieutenant's woman and other things, you know, going forwards and backwards, but it really does glide, and you really do tease the themes of the tyranny in the pirate realm into the modern form of tyranny, the parallel. We are pattern tracking beings, and you do that really well. So in pirate realm, we have Flaming Jane, right, who's a very woofy. You're exploring the, you know, what is an equal relationship between equally spicy, erudite, you know, jousting, trickster-hearted, you know, man and woman, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly right. And as I was writing it, and even after now it has been done, I was never exactly certain what the actual relationship between the modern day and the pirate side of this story was. There was one notion that maybe it's reincarnation, right? But I have my own reservations about that as a concept, which I discuss later on in the book. And, you know, there's another possibility that it might just be that, you know, the pirate side of the story might just be a more archetypal, more visceral echo of the of what's happening in the modern world, right? So it was definitely interesting, though, to write the same, more or less the same cast of characters in two different contexts, because there's just certain things that fit into, you know, a swashbuckling pirate story, right, that just wouldn't land well at all into the modern day. And so it became necessary to sort of deepen the characters and create a context where they were struggling against the same sort of obstacles, but those obstacles were taking a somewhat more hidden form in the modern world.
Right. Well, again, I mean, always, I think, you know, it's a dedicated theme that runs through your work and through our lives now of, you know, how do we insource our outsourced autonomy? So you have the bad characters in the swashbuckling realm who are very much themselves, and then you tease it into the bad character. And how do we deal with tyranny? You know, in what way? And what kind of Aikido moves and bravado and trickster aplomb and ingenuity? And then you tease it into the modern world where the villain in the pirate realm is Ivan, the cult leader. And I do have to do an aside, because the reason I didn't want to rush through this book at all is I put a little yellow marker on almost every page of very well-turned phrases and things and notes too, and just, you know, the frosting on, you know, the tyrannical con spiritual guru whose vanity plates are namaste. And I go, oh, get him, sure. Get him, Tony, that's great. Because, you know, two things. One is when I went to India and as a tiny, tiny young person, I was disabused of using namaste because all the Westerners were going namaste, namaste, and the Indians were appalled, you know, and they mocked people going namaste because it's a deep thing. And then I do just have to tell you this brief story that could be in your novel. Fellow radio guest Alex Stefan was in a crosswalk in La Castro, and a woman in a big SUV hit him, right? Knocked him down, mm-hmm. and started to back up and go away, but was surrounded by an angry mob of gay allies, and she was like, ah, and my friend Alex dusted himself off, and the woman in the SUV said, are we done here? Because I'm late for yoga. Anyway, it's like, oh, perfect, perfect, which is very much in your novel, right? And you talk about latte consciousness queens, and, you know, and you do some powerful magic when the characters in the modern world, you know, the woman Lila says, you know, let's play what's really reality, you know, be angry at me. And then you do a really good job of, you know, don't boss me around. And then they get into an argument, but they have a safe word, which is really, really great. And it's a really great argument. I mean, again, it's quite crafted. Have you been involved in such arguments yourself to know so well how it could go and then how to get out?
Oh, I certainly don't have a safety word.
well, it's a good idea, though.
It is. It would be wonderful if we could, in our relationships, like, somehow agree upon a safety word in advance. And not only that, but then remember to use it. That's what's tricky.
Right.
Right?
No, but that's why your novel is in a deft and playful and spirally way. It does serve as a training manual, because it's like that was a great, ruse of multi-layered, remembering that illusion comes from in ludo, which means in the game, and delusion is de ludo, out of the game, right? So entering into the illusion, which you do so well, and then it seems to become real, but then you have the safe word, and it is riposte and repartee and insult, which is part of a trickster art, but it does get mean, right? And then they have their safe word, which is, and then they decide, look, let's not do that again. It was too real. There's so much that I love here, with the Holy Company of Beautiful People with the Namaste license plate. That's really good. Yeah, and the whole idea of chosen people, right, which again is anathema to our free-spirited trickster selves, something that, by the why not now, but it really wants to go into the cauldron, right?
Sure, and that's kind of a technique of manipulation in general, is if you can identify an in-group versus an out-group, and that enhances in-group solidarity and conformity, right? I mean, we see this happening at on a stage of national politics all the time, right? As long as you can identify, a scapegoat or an outsider, right, then people get, very riled up in terms of defending what they think is the in-group. Well, of course, all of it's just an illusion that's being cast by, some politician or another, right? But the real world consequences are there.
Well, and I love how you and through your characters you do revel in words and etymology, and I go, oh, I love that too. It's so great. Although you did inform me, because I am always looking things up, going, because when they're in their courting, I see you one and raise you one, modern romance, which is quite beguiling. They're doing wordplay, and Lila says, I adore you, and then adore is good, and then, how about revere, and I guess the character says, revere means to fear, and I'm like, oh, phooey. Because I love reverence, but I did look it up, and it's like, oh, it's got some good things in it, but it does come from to fear, and I go, so it is a kind of Yahweh thing, right?
It is interesting. That's actually the origin of the phrase to be God-fearing.
Oh. Right?
And it's this reference to reverence. And I enjoyed that, because I've always sort of identified with the irreverent. I think in that conversation in the book that you are citing, one or the other of the characters mentions that, the holiest people in church are the children snickering in the pews.
Yeah.
That, who was it? John Cleese from Monty Python, right?
Sure.
I was watching a talk that he was giving, and he actually has this dictum against reverence.
Mm-hmm.
He says that he actually doesn't know what it's for, aside from, enforcing one point of view at the expense of all other points of view, right?
Yeah.
If you're not behaving yourself according to how, this local social structure tells you that you're behaving yourself, then you're being bad, right? But if you look deeply into the word, it's ultimately, if it's based on fear, then it ultimately does seem somewhat tyrannical.
Yeah, it's a con. So I want a word to replace what I thought it meant, because I've been talking about, relabeling environmentalists as sane, reverent people and being in service to sane reverence. I thought it meant respect in a good way, but no, it's got a sneakier thing. So we do want to stir the cauldron and come up with something that I thought it meant. Oh, fooey. But the reason I went off in that direction is, yeah, we love words. we love words. So the word privilege means private law. And we go, oh, there you have it. There you have it. So the chosen people.
Well, that's a good one. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, no, we can do etymology wordplay because your characters do. They do in a kind of Aikido Dharma combat in a spirally liberating to everybody way with words, which is why I was so happy. Like, oh, that's so wonderful. Yeah, and the word respect means to look at again, respect, again, look.
Mm-hmm.
So we love that. So insourcing our outsourced Saturn, which is why I also think that this book that I think the last time we spoke was 7 years ago when you had nine kinds of naked, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So have you been working on this for 7 years?
Oh, fits and starts. I moved across the country. I had an accident that put me out of commission for about 6 months. The book itself has been done probably for close to 2 years. It's just a agonizingly long and grueling process of publishing. It took this long for it to finally, be released.
Well, you know, if one of your main themes is trickster, it's a wild ride to even get the thing done. But we might say, but now, because as I'm reading it, I just go, it is so perfect for now. And I would spiral out to our dedicated listening team going, this is worthy of making all of Tony Vigorito's adventures and misadventures, pay off, because this book is so now. It's the medicine for now. It's liberating laughter. It deals with all of the themes about tyranny and the con. And there's no bigger theme right now, than being freed from bamboozlement and snookering and the razzle dazzle con. And you're, it's multidimensional, to and fro, lots of levels. It's about, freedom from the con. And now is when we most need this. So, we regret your suffering, but we honor your perfect timing in skidding in whatever way.
I really appreciate you saying that. It didn't actually occur to me until January 20th on the inauguration that at its most fundamental level, Love of the Pranks is about malignant narcissism that is ultimately overthrown by an empowered femininity.
Yep.
And aided and abetted by an enlightened masculinity that's willing to follow her lead.
Well said. Ah, yeah.
And I was horrified by the election, but I was pleased that my amusing little story might have something relevant to contribute to the larger cultural conversation.
Oh, completely. Which is why I'm savoring every page, going, oh, as Mark Twain said, or allegedly said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Mm-hmm. So I like putting, 11, 9, 16 are the horrible election results coming in and the unfurling horror of now going, oh, and 11, 9, 1938 is Kristallnacht, and 11, 9, 1989 is the fall of the Berlin Wall, which the Germans chose to redeem that date. So for me, January 20th was Kristallnacht, right? And January 21st, the global women and the men who love them, and youth and everybody, that was the fall of the Berlin Wall. We go, oh, that was the real inauguration of the guiding story, which you just articulated, the malignant narcissist who's overthrown by the woofy woman and the man wise enough to, well, you said it better. I won't presume, but yeah, the equal dynamic, and the idea of, who's really up for this teasing democracy into, every particle of our being and our way of relating, including romance and love. Who's really up for that tricky, windy adventure? But it's the only really infinite game in town, right? So that's but there's a lot, about, yes, the malignant narcissist and overcoming of tyranny, and you touch on, in the modern cult, and then there's the pirate cult too. But one of the one of the characters says, you know, that the guru, the false Khan guru, who looks right, you know, and people bamboozled, but they must always be under threat. And it's a shaman shadow, I think. There's many good shamans, of course. Everybody settle down. But part of the shadow of shamanism is under attack, going, we are great, and therefore these forces or the heretics, again, heretic was a term of praise once, you know, the heretics are out to get us, you know, whatever. And I think that's very important, you know, as people put their discerning berms or criterion as things rush towards them, going, does it guide people to their own autonomy? Is there any of this, you know, we are great and therefore we're under threat thing, which is always, it's always a cult shadow, uh-oh, right?
Sure. When I was reading literary theory, one thing I came across that's always stuck with me is this notion that you never have a tyrant in a story without a scapegoat, and vice versa, right? That tyranny and scapegoating are basically two sides of the same coin, and that holds true in literature, and it also holds true in history, right? So if you look at, say, Hitler, right, 20th century's most well-known tyrant, right, to call him a tyrant has no meaning without reference to the scapegoats, right? Or if you look at Richard Nixon, right, another sort of tyrannical president, but again, he needed to have these scapegoats, and for him, the scapegoats were, you know, various domestic wars, such as the war on drugs, for example, which was really a proxy war against, you know, those portions of the population that he felt politically threatened by, right? So that's where that notion comes from, that if you're going to have a tyrannical character, then that character is always going to be distracting attention from their own failures by locating people's attention onto that of the scapegoat or the outsider, you know, whether they are immigrants or whether they are Muslims or whether they are, you know, inner city African Americans or Jews in Nazi Germany, right? The same pattern holds throughout.
Absolutely. No, tyrant needs scapegoat, and that is part of, again, what the welcoming embrace of historic now to your book, Love and Other Pranks, because we're just shooting the rapids of the first part of this Three Stooges cartoon Hitler dynamic that's going on right now, and see, the conversation was really pertinent when we had Trump and Bernie, right, because one was the liberating, authentic trickster, Bernie, the wizard, really, and Trump was the con, and Hillary just didn't seem to have a story, and that's why I was like, oh no, dear. But that made it really clear, and that's why, you know, I did go to, you know, Cleveland and Philadelphia as part of Pacifica's campaign coverage, and also the Mythic News, and that's why I did enjoy playing with the Trump supporters, going, let me give you some quotes from Trump and ISIS or Daesh, and you tell me which is which. And they couldn't. They couldn't. They were the same. You know, because everybody wants to be invited to a story, but that was the toxic mimic of the hero story. And, you know, Bernie was saying, here's how we're being snookered, and, you know, and here's what we're going to do about it. And Trump was like, here's how we're being snookered, and it's those people, right? And so I tried to spiral in, to, you know, across borders, going, everybody wants to know how they're being snookered. And everybody could agree with that, right? The Trump people, like, yeah. Absolutely. You know, and I think that's the purpose of satire, and one of the side effects of reading your novel Love and Other Pranks is to have the con be, you know, to enter into the con and then to be, have it be revealed and escape, to reveal and escape, and these are skills we want, but in the delicious form of novels. I mean, do you read a lot of novels?
Not as many as I used to, but I still read a few novels a year. I used to be much more voracious in my appetite. I think just the responsibilities of life start crowding out that sort of free time. But yeah, I mean, some people, because I mentioned earlier that I'm also a social psychologist, and when people find that out, that I'm a social psychologist and a novelist, they oftentimes look at me quizzically, like those seem, I guess on the face of it, they seem to be radically different occupations, whereas I look at them and I see them as, you know, cut of the same cloth. I mean, in social psychology, like the basic precept to be understood is that reality is an illusion. Social reality is an illusion, that we are constantly being told stories, and we're constantly telling ourselves stories and casting ourselves within these stories, and, you know, recruiting audience members to, you know, validate the story that we wish to inhabit, so on and so forth. And so, like, the practice of social psychology is very much akin to fiction, right? I think the crucial difference is that fiction knows it's make-believe, right? Whereas the human psyche doesn't necessarily know that it's inhabiting a make-believe world made out of social constructs. And so that's in all of my books, I'm always trying to underline that fact for the reader, to remind them that this is a story that you're reading, and it's also a story that you're living.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love neuroscience some years back coming out proudly proclaiming their study, going, we've discovered that people remember things better when they're in stories. And we go, you cute little whippersnapper neuroscience. But because I think people remember things in stories, but I think they also learn best. I mean, I speak for myself, because it's, I mean, you've taken a lot of social psychologists, good cover, training for your kind-hearted, discerning, spicy, satiric eye, right? And you've animated it where it's available, and that's why I'm grateful. Like, so you responsible person, no time to read novels, only to write them, and we go, no, because I never like to be without a novel. It's changed a little bit, but that's why I'm so delighted to be in Love and Other Pranks, because it's like, oh, that's really good, because it's pertinent, it's delicious, it's irresistible. The writing is really great. I'm not just blowing smoke, and you know, it's really deft and skilled and honed and smart and liberating and satiric, and so that's my idea of kind of heaven. Going, you've provided this, you know, for others, and I do want to spiral it out to our team, because it's like, it's so pertinent, you know, what you were laying out for us, because in California culture, and then on out, of course, into everywhere. But it's poignant that it's the people who are kind of suspicious of surface conventionality, you know, who that good-hearted inquiry can be so easily snookered into, again, outsourcing their autonomy to a bamboozling con of varying degrees of sophistication. The desire to be special, the desire to have privilege, you know. Here we go, these are Velcro adhesions that will attract not good stories, right? So, I mean, I don't know if you ponder, like, what is the effect you want to have on your reader? I mean, is that something that you keep in mind when you're writing, or not really?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Ezra Pound once wrote that the book should be a ball of light in one's hand. And so I always sort of, I sort of aim for that, right? I don't know, if I always hit it, but I'm wanting lights to go off, in the reader's mind. Not only in the telling of the story and whatever philosophies are explored or expressed, but also in my use of syntax. I like to use, you know, familiar words in unfamiliar ways, just to show people that, and my hope is that I'm trying to show people that they know more than they think they do. They already understand more than they're aware of, right? And so, yeah, I'm hoping to leave the reader exhilarated, for lack of a better word.
Right.
I try to write the kind of books I would want to read.
If you had time, right? Yeah.
If I had time, yes.
So, no, that's great. Well, I think so. We're going to take a very, very short break right now with wonderful Taj Mahal. Our guest is Tony Vigorito. His latest novel is Love and Other Pranks, and in the spirit of Tom Robbins, who praises it, maybe the single wildest novel I've ever read, and with two drops of Philip K. Dick, and I mean other people that we can bring in, Ishmael Reed. All kinds of stuff, and we will be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Channy, 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 come blow my channy home. Ooh, channy, 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 come blow my channy home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our guest today is Tony Vigorito, whose latest novel is Love and Other Pranks, that we really want to spiral out to the whole Bay Area and beyond, you know, and again, and it is liberating satire, but with a good heart. I mean, it's liberating satire, but being an antidote to the toxic mimic of what passes for, you know, grumpy social critique, because you are dedicated to ecstatic joy and courtship, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that's nicely articulated.
Yeah, and I do, you know, because there is a great courtship. Maybe we can track that theme a little bit. You have your two main characters who move very deftly, again, not everybody can pull this off, between 18th century and modern California, San Francisco, very Santa Cruz-ish, very, I mean, everything, as well. You know, and courtship. I remember when last time I was hosting Martine Prechtel, and, you know, he had a rare joke. He said, you know, humans and courtship, we really want to bring this back, animals court. And he said, what passes for courtship among American men, he said, is, look, I made a golden statue of myself for you. Right. Anyway, so, which is useful, right? And again, you're so good at, setting up the con and then the bamboozling escape. Because, I mean, would you say that both of your protagonists, Flaming Jane and Crow, and then in the modern world, Lila and Merlin, same beings, really, in a shapeshifty, wonderful way. But they're courting, right?
Sure, sure. And, you know, in another interview I did, the interviewer was asking me about what's the relationship between love and piracy, and my answer was that essentially in love you're hoping to steal back your own heart, right? It's a heart that has been sort of colonized and diminished by, you know, participation in social structures that have sort of convinced you that you're in this life alone and you can only count on yourself, so on and so forth. And then love is this, the pursuit of love and courtship, right, is essentially this, it's disproving that thesis that at the end, that it turns out that you're not in this life alone. I'm not even just talking about romantic love. Romantic love is just a sort of stand-in for universal love, right? When it's properly conceived. But that's, I think, what I was aiming for, right? And, you know, in the same way that a pirate is a refugee and a revolutionary to their culture, I think that love provides us, again, both in the romantic and the universal sense, love provides us with a refuge from our culture while also promising this sort of revolutionary expansion of human consciousness if it is pursued, if it is fully pursued.
No, I love that. And another kind of honoring love that runs through your book, Love and Other Pranks, I'm pitching it because I want to, is animals. I'm so grateful for Moby or Mobius the parrot and Catface the cat, and that they are honored for their autonomy. And some of the most moving, beautiful parts, I'm looking at page 78, when Crow is in terrible servitude to the evil gold tooth, you know, but he does cleverly, again, a trick, a liberating trick, win a parrot that is in terrible circumstance and gives it its autonomy. And then it's just a beautiful moment. I don't know if you have your book handy right now, but I do, because I underlined the thing, and because he sees the parrot spiraling into the sky. Do you want to take over from here? I don't want to run over your own words and narrative.
Let's see. Say page 78.
Well, yeah. It's page 78. It's the very bottom. That whole paragraph is actually pretty great. Crow grinned, gazing amazed as Moby flew high into the sky, until he heard.
Oh, yeah. And then as he watched him ascend, he remembered his own freedom. Right?
Yeah.
The meaning there was that in freeing this parrot, Moby, right? In freeing this parrot, he was ultimately freeing himself, right?
Right, but you write it better than either one of us is speaking right now. Just the very last sentence, yeah. you just go, because he has to do this horrible thing of carry the poop of the tyrant out and slop it overboard and everything, and he doesn't mind once he sees the parrot, you know, and he goes, Moby the parrot's ongoing ascent into the overwhelming immensity of the sky, and Crow remembered that he was, and he always had been, and he always would be absolutely free. It's just...
Yeah.
It's just great. It's just, you know, it's just like, yes, that's really great. The animals are important characters, and the affection, the autonomous affection between them is that's part of my criterion in a good book, is does it treat its animals well? And if it doesn't, I really won't go there. But also I love, you know, Lila gets into trouble because she's always sassing after Satsang, right? These are troublemakers. This is the part of all of us that, you know, from third grade on that got colonized or quelled, you know, but then there's as you in the arduous writing of the book, it's true that, you know, a trickster within us all does break rules, and there are some difficult consequences, but then spirals back. I mean, and have you landed, ta-ta, on your feet from the journey of writing this book and the cataclysmic and liberating things that occurred to you during the writing?
Oh, I would certainly say so. I mean, this book sort of acted as art therapy for myself. Just as I was moving through various, you know, passages in my own personal life, the cult I talked to you about that I befriended some of its ex-members in Austin, Texas, right? That was just, you know, one piece of my own personal biography that was finding its way into this book.
Oops. Did we just lose you? We might have just lost you. I can carry on. I have plenty of Tony Vigorito quotes. Let me see. Okay. There are many Tony Vigorito quotes, and I can actually read from the book again, Love and Other Pranks, which is wonderful. But also Tony Vigorito on Twitter and website TonyVigorito.com is really great. You know, because there's also a dedicated liberating author as well as satirist, and they do want to go together. You know, he writes, if we can view life as a vortex, then geometrically involution spirals inward and down, while evolution spirals outward and up. And again, this is a theme in all of us who love trickster spirals in nature. You know, when conflicting forces come together, spirals ensue. It's nature's guiding Aikido. Again, how do we spiral out of disaster and into considering? There we go. So he says, involution then is when we descend into the world of illusion and separation, the bottom of the vortex, so to speak. This is the dream of ego, the fall into the finite matter and distinction, where our minds contract and perception is limited. Evolution, alternatively, is when we see through the illusion of separation, when we ascend out of the vortex and reconnect to the universe of undivided unity of which we're ultimately indistinct. Awakening to the infinite, our minds expand and perception is unlimited. Therefore, don't get involved, get evolved. So there's that kind of dynamic, and we do love that. Things I want to bring into play, and perhaps Tony will be. Oh, he's back. He's back. Okay, I was just reading yourself to as filler here. But I'm glad you returned, because I also want to speak about, you know, so there you are, you know, as your cover in a way as social psychologist and novelist, and the realm of satire, which is so crucial. Remember, the Celts thought that, you know, only the satirist could bring down the power-abusing tyrant. And that one of the traditions was the satirist would present artful critique to the tyrant, and the tyrant would have to respond in artful kind, not pertinent in our current circumstance, you know, but pertinent in your novel. And whoever's critique was less true, the ground would open up and eat them. We go, God, let's bring that back. It's why I called Trump Trumpelstiltskin, because we remember the end of that fairy tale where he gets into such a peak that he pounds his foot on the podium and plunges into the underworld. And we go, to be redeemed somewhere, you know, there we go. So have you loved satire for a long time? Is that a kind of dedicated craft early on?
Absolutely, it's pretty much all I read. And when I was younger, worked my way through the entire corpus of Kurt Vonnegut,
yes,
followed by Douglas Adams, right? Of course, Tom Robbins, Robert Anton Wilson. I've read some Neal Stephenson. My main challenge is these days I think finding the types of books that I want to be reading. Books that, which tend to be the books that are not quite so self-serious, that are, I think that my feeling is that some fiction, I feel, doesn't take full advantage of what fiction, of the possibilities that fiction offers us as writers, right? If the art form is make-believe, right, then I feel like they hold back a little, too many writers hold back from just inventing something, right, that something other than everyday reality, I guess, is what I'm trying, what I'm reaching for here.
Sure.
And so I think that's why my books say, while they take place in something resembling consensus reality, you know, around the edges of the story, it always sort of drifts into surrealism or magic realism or something, you know, just to give the reader a sense that, you know, we're not entirely sure what's happening here, right? And your interpretations are welcome to this story as well as the story of your own life.
Well, yeah, and I think that's why what's so effective and works really well in what we want, you know, is the swashbuckling, liberating play of the 18th century interweaving with modern, I mean, I'll say California, but it, you know, because it so deftly addresses and translates all of these things into the culture that is in California, and then of course resonant, you know, all the way out there. But you know, we really would want everybody in the Bay Area and Santa Cruz, you know, and these are like the first initial likely reader is going, no, you really do want to read this thing, you know, and so Kurt Vonnegut, yes, Tom Robbins, absolutely. Although I love Jitterbug Perfume, which this book is quite akin to, but again, you've taken the baton and moved it into immediate cultural pertinence. And as I said backstage, I go, I love Jitterbug Perfume by Tom Robbins. It's 3/5 a brilliant book, but then at the end, he just sort of kicks over the sandcastle and doesn't really know quite how to end the thing. We're glad he blurbed your book. Robert Anton Wilson, yes, the Illuminatus trilogy, very fabulous kind of fantasy or pertinent satiric, multi-layered, Bible of the 70s, and it's still incredibly pertinent. I don't know if you remember, in the Illuminatus trilogy, there's a word, Fëanord. Do you remember Fëanord?
I do.
Right. So, it's pertinent to us. It's a word that we would be conditioned or colonized to not hear when spoken, but it would drive us into a state of paralytic confusion and therefore obedience to tyranny. So the news readers would begin, "Good evening, Fëanord." Anyway, it was just a very good conceit, and also, did you ever love Stanislaw Lem?
Oh, that's a new name to me. I'd have to listen to that.
Oh, okay. Well, Stanislaw Lem, The Futurological Congress, is one of the most deft, brilliant, pertinent, short satire ever. Really great for now. Again, layers of reality within reality within reality. A great inspiration. But yes, I will remind the audience as well that the Futurological Congress is a work of deft, prescient genius. Again, written I guess in the early 60s. It's Polish. Brilliant translation. And all about border guards and bands and tyranny and multiple layers of reality and cons within cons, and which it's a culture in which everybody is on mass cons, which they don't know about, but then everybody's taking pharmaceuticals for anyway. It goes on, but it's I put that to one side. And then there's Mark Twain. Is he a kind of ancestral colleague, mysterious stranger, and all?
Oh yeah, I mean I first read Tom Sawyer. I think I was still in grade school. When I started reading Mark Twain, yeah, he was an early favorite of mine. But I did want to mention before we drift too far from Robert Anton Wilson that he always had a quote that stuck with me. He had a quote that's always stuck with me, which was, "It's not true if it doesn't make you laugh."
Oh, good.
And that for me if I could have used that, say, as an epigraph, an opening quote for this story, I think that might have been an equally suitable one, right?
Perfect.
And I think that expresses well the sort of trickster archetype that you're discussing. The other one, let's say, it's not true if it doesn't make you laugh. And then his other quote that's always stuck with me is, "I don't believe anything. And as soon as I start believing something, I stop thinking about it." Right. And so again, that's what I'm always on about in my writing, is just encouraging the reader to revel in the creation of their own story, right? That the story that our culture has socialized its members into, here we are, it's working well enough, right? But, we can do better, right? And in fact, we deserve to do better, right? The story we're inhabiting was written by people no different than ourselves, right? And I would like to see humanity increasingly, participating in the ongoing creation of the story that we and our children get to inhabit.
No, absolutely. I think there's nothing more important. And just the kind of beautiful sky story of now, Jupiter is story craft, it's opposite Uranus, to bring old things alive in a fresh and liberating way, is really pertinent. And when you said, quoted, Robert Anton Wilson going, "I don't believe anything because then I might stop thinking about it." And I coined my own fun thing, believe nothing, entertain possibilities. And because all this flotsam and jetsam of culture, of liberating culture is rising now, of which your book, Love and Other Pranks by Tony Vigoretto, rush out and get it now. I'm not being paid to do this. I just really love it. For instance, just that quote, things rising into synchronicity. I watched a smidge of the day the Earth stood still that wafted across the screen going, I remember when I saw that first. And there's a great moment where, the space being has come to, teach manners to humans because we're destroying everything. And they do stage this moment of Well, he meets the great scientist, and he goes, and the scientist says, "Yes, I will help you." And the space being says, "Oh, you have faith in me." And the scientist says, "No. I'm a scientist. I have curiosity, not faith." Anyway, I just like that. You know, let's take faith and even belief and throw it into the cauldron and label out curiosity, which really is a more liberating kind of dynamic. Going, what's up with that? What's up with that?
Sure.
And yeah, as you say, you know, dedication to reveling in the creation of our own story and to live as though it's true and all of that. And then here's a book I have not read, but I keep thinking that I should. Many people have told me to, which is Herman Melville's The Confidence Man. Do you know that?
I'm aware of it.
Yeah, I think right. Anyway, I'll get back to you on that, because again, you know, part of the American psyche that you're kind of receiving the baton and then customizing it and making it incredibly, you know, witty and liberating and pertinent to us now. You know, there is this tradition of, you know, people, Mark Twain and Herman Melville and Jonathan Swift in Ireland, you know, and Philip K. Dick here, although not as jaunty. You know, we wish Philip K. Dick had been happier, but you know, there you go. And Tom Robbins, I hope he's pretty happy. But anyway, that idea of, you know, long themes of this kind of liberating dynamic, but the essence that is blooming now of, you know, how can Americans in myriad forms, and now maybe even especially allegedly spiritual, be so snookered? And then what is the authentic, you know, what is the authentic spice and how we can feel that texture? So that's great. I also, maybe you can take us, the word play is so great because the boats, of course, the boat from the Gold Tooth terrible character is, you know, is christened the Damnation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the liberated by Flaming Jane boat of an egalitarian crew of misfits. See, this is such an important dream for all of us. You know, is then named the Eleusis, right? And I love that. Do you want to say more about Eleusis versus Damnation?
Oh, well, that was a reference to I guess anthropologists call it the Eleusinian Mysteries, which were a ritual in ancient Greece, where the participants would have some sort of a visionary experience that would enable them to see through the illusion of their social world, right? And then come out of that, you know, wizened, essentially. And so I've always found that sort of a fascinating footnote in the history of Western civilization. And yeah, so I was just sort of alluding to that with the name of their ship. That would be, you know, that would be sort of the opposite of what we might recognize as damnation. You know, I think I say elsewhere in the book that a devil imagines itself to be alone and against the entire universe, right? Yeah, which is very much, I would say, it's the opposite of being in a state of love, right? When you're in a state of love, you're not alone, and you don't experience the entire universe as something that's confronting you. Instead, you feel yourself as being an expression of that very thing.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, it is the trickster homage of a dance through time of equal yab and yum, equal, really, really great that way. And we go, Eleusis, yeah, again, coming through your novel, a little more than a footnote. It ran for 1,000 years of initiation. Everybody was initiated, men, women, children, slaves. It was once in a lifetime because it was pricey. But yeah, that's
right. Yeah, when I say footnote, I mean it's not something that's generally emphasized.
Right.
In terms of...
Yeah. No, it's true. Until now. Right, exactly. That's right. Well, it's a good juxtaposition against the damnation, right? Because it's like once humans had ways of gathering, sometimes with psychoactive plants, of ways of gathering their wits and their autonomous vision. So that's quite wonderful. And then there's also, again, just the language. So I love the parrot being free, and I love Mobius, and the holy company of beautiful people, the Namaste vanity plate. And then, wait, there's also, here's a wonderful thing you said too. You talk about, Or one of your characters says, irony is a force in the world, Flaming Jane had explained to Crow, and this will ensure our good fortune. That's fun. So do you want to say more about irony? I love irony.
Yeah. It's just that, again, it's this reminder that we're living in a story, right? In terms of human history, it is very much a story, because that is what human beings do, is we tell ourselves a story that enables us to make sense of our place in the universe, and we tell one another stories, and we cast other people into our story, and we try to enforce them into the role that we've put them in. And so I find that it's useful to apply literary theory, right, to understanding human history, right? And all the same devices that apply in literature, such as irony, I think also apply in human history, right? So we do have ironic twists in the unfolding of history, right? You know, I look at recent politics in the United States, and if you look at it through this lens, it almost feels like we're living in some madman's satire of late capitalism, right? Where some bloviating billionaire could actually seize control of the republic, right, and just turn the volume up to 11 in terms of all of the consequences of inequality and all of the shadow of American history come back to haunt us, right? It's just remarkable. It's a remarkable thing to witness. And then that doesn't absolve us from the real human tragedy that's resulting, right? And yet I do find it useful to sort of step back and look at it as if it were a story.
Yes.
That makes sense.
Oh, no, it's beautiful. We're on our way out. But yes, the bloviating billionaire, perfect. And the positive intrigue of pirate disobedience as wonderful. And we want our rapscallion gang of crazy misfits and disobedient tricksters that you've, animated and provided for us at this perfect time. Our guest is Tony Vigorito, Love and Other Pranks. Go out and get it. I'm saying this just cause I want to, not cause anybody told me to. But thank you so much, Tony, for your brilliant, saucy, liberating offering to us at this time, which is so perfect. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on the show, Caroline. It was tremendously fun.
That's great. And thanks always to Alex Drewinskis in Washington, D.C., and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Go there for Equinox events, and follow me on Twitter at StandUpCoyote. We will reconvene next week with Lady Liberty and the story of the Statue of Liberty and how she's coming alive. Woof.
Be sure to catch Apex Express on KPFA. Apex Express is a weekly program following news and cultural events throughout Asia and the Pacific Islands. Find out about issues affecting Asian American and Pacific Islander communities locally and globally. Get on board the Apex Express Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. on KPFA.
Luna Dance Institute invites you to their Silver Jubilee Dance Party, featuring aerial dance performances, live DJ, cash bar, and savory food stations. The fundraiser takes place Saturday, March 18th at 8 p.m. at the beautiful David Brower Center in downtown Berkeley. This is a benefit for Luna Dance Institute's 25th year of bringing creativity, equity, and community to children through the art of dance. For tickets, Call 510-883-1118 or visit lunadanceinstitute.org. This event is wheelchair accessible. Listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248 BR.